You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
We got another day of NBA action. And with FanDuel, every night is a watch party. So it's time for your FanDuel crew to make their bets. So, what's the move tonight, gang? You know the new customers who bet $5 get $150 back in bonus bets? Woohoo! We're heating up, fam! Bet all the stars with all your friends and make every moment more, only on FanDuel. New customers bet $5, get $150 back in bonus bets. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
It goes down in the DM. It go down in the DM.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Oh yeah, what's this? I feel this. Oh yeah, this is Oh no.
WhamGoat presents the Van Flip Podcast.
What's good, everybody? Welcome back to another installment of the Van Flip. This week, we are joined by Matt from Memphis Mayfire, as well as Alex via the call-in again. So how are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing good, man. How you doing?
Great. You're currently on tour.
Yeah.
Who are you on tour with again? Remind me real quick.
We're out with a band called Pop Evil.
Okay.
And mixed in with it, we're doing a handful of headliner dates as well.
Dope.
Yeah.
And how's the tour been treating you so far?
It's good, man. We're really early on, so it's tough to say, exactly what the vibe of the tour is, at this point, but we've had a couple of great shows and the guys in Pop Evil and Gal, are great. They're great people. So it's been awesome.
I'm just going to probably ask you not to touch.
Sorry.
The yeah, just because I'm sure people are going to be like, oh, I can hear like the
oh man. Thing. Yeah. That's probably a habit of mine that I've never noticed before.
What do I do with my hands?
Yeah. Right? I'll put them both on the headphones here.
It's a problem. It gets to be a problem sometimes just to realize you're doing it too. So you guys are, summer's coming up too. And, it's not your first time on the festival circuit, correct?
No, No. We've done it, a couple times, and we actually had a couple more that we were going to be doing this summer that we had to cancel because we confirmed the Disrupt, the Rockstar Disrupt tour.
Cool.
And so there was a bunch of competing markets, and so we had to jump off a couple of the other festivals that we were doing. But no, it'll be a good summer, man. We've got a lot of cool stuff planned.
Do you find that, like, you guys get radius clauses too, I'm assuming, with those festivals? So, like, if you play at a certain festival, you can't play it within a radius?
Absolutely. Yeah. The radius clause for festivals is pretty harsh. It's a lot more than just like what a club tour would be.
Yeah.
And rightfully so, obviously. So we have to stay out of those markets for a while.
Do you find that to become like annoying or anything like that? Cause I think as a fan, I should say, cause in other genres of music, like we talked prior to the podcast, they like electronic festivals per se are king of radius clauses, like
yeah.
600, 800 miles.
You know,
insane thing. So as a fan, I think it does kind of bums me out a little bit when you can't see a band for at least 6 months because you know, like, oh, well, so-and-so is definitely going to be at such and such festival. So
totally. Yeah. I mean, it really comes down to, the biggest bummer is the people that can't come out to that festival. You know what I mean? Cause that's your one time to play anywhere within that vicinity. But I get it though, you know, like if it was me that was putting the festival on, I would want the same thing, you know, cause you don't want an artist to, you know, saturate a market before they come. Those festivals are big risks for the people that put them on, you know? So I get it, you know, it's pros and cons.
It's a, you know, it's a catch 22 as they like to call it, huh?
It is. Yeah.
Do you find what's more, where do you find more success? Would it be in the festival realm, or do you find like just either playing supporting tours or headlining tours in clubs and whatnot? benefit you better.
I think it's two different types of success. I think that in the festival realm, we get an opportunity to play for a much larger crowd and hopefully win over people or play for people that have never even heard of us before.
Right.
And when we go out on club tours, that's when people really see us in our environment. You know, I think that festivals are important. But I think that rock and roll is meant to be seen in the dark.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree.
And so it's, there's good in both, but, I would say that if we gain a fan at a festival, I hope that they see us in a club within the next few months.
Right. I think that's with anything too. If anybody gains a fan, they would like to come see them in a more intimate scenario.
Absolutely. Yeah.
One of the drawbacks I think of being in the festival, circuit and being a band on the festival circuit probably is that you don't get a long set time. Sometimes it's 20 minutes, sometimes it's only an hour, depending on your stardom level, I would guess.
But
as a fan, again, that's kind of like a drawback too. You go see a band that you kind of are into and they play at noon, you know, and
totally,
and they play 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think it's all just about like, well, I only get to see this band for 30 minutes, but I get to see four of my favorite bands today, and it kind of makes up for it. You know, I think different bands feel differently about short sets. I love short sets. being that I both sing and scream for the band, the 20, the 30 minute, the 35, you know, like the Warped Tour length sets or whatever were awesome for me. My voice was never affected like it is on a headlining tour where we're playing an hour and 15. So I really prefer it, but the other guys are like, man, we're not playing for long enough. And I'm like,
yeah, my instrument has wear and tear though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
exactly.
There's the two, but it's, you know,
I can't take my throat to Guitar Center.
Right.
You know, unfortunately,
it's a totally different kind of place.
Thank goodness. They screwed up. Sorry, Guitar Center.
They're not sponsoring us yet. So it's okay. Hint, hint. No,
they won't now.
Thanks, Alex. You ruined it. But anyway, continuing on, we were talking about the festival situation.
Yeah.
I kind of lost the train of thought. Alex.
Yeah, I'm good at that.
So anyway, go ahead.
Well,
go ahead.
That's all right. So you live in Nashville
yes, sir.
Now, right? And you're from Washington.
Yeah, originally from Spokane.
As
Washington
in,
State, okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's quite a difference. So what's the biggest difference you think between the Northwest and the friendly South?
I mean, exactly just what you said. I mean, the people in the South are friendly. you know, growing up in Spokane, and we also lived in Seattle as well, we were just really used to the weather, used to the way that people interact. And, when we moved to Dallas, when I joined Memphis May Fire, you know, and then we moved to Atlanta, you know, and then we went back to Seattle and we were like, whoa, you know, we really prefer the South. And it's, you know, Seattle and Spokane, I mean, they have great things to offer. I mean, beautiful scenery and things like that, but just, you know, Southern hospitality and, manners and, you know, Southern food as well. We definitely prefer it. So, you know, it's home for us. And when I was really young, my sister married one of the Tennessee Titans. So I used to go down and visit her in Nashville. And, that's kind of how I fell in love with the city. So when my wife and I were looking at buying our first house, we were like, you know, let's settle down in Tennessee. Cause I think that's where we'll want to be long term.
Boo Titans.
Yeah. We're Seahawks fans anyways, you know, just by default.
We're a stone's throw away from the Jaguar Stadium too.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's
yeah.
a little bad blood between the two.
But why Nashville and not Memphis? I mean, come on. That was
predestined. Have you ever visited Memphis before?
No, I've never actually been to – I'm actually going to Tennessee for the first time this summer.
If you visit Memphis, you'll understand why we don't live in Memphis. It's a completely different vibe than it is in Nashville. It's just, you know, there's some pockets in Memphis that are cool, but just as a whole, it's nothing like Nashville.
Yeah, Nashville is a little more cultured to begin with.
It is,
yeah. It's a lot more stuff going on. Are you a fan of country music or –
I respect all kinds of music. People are going to hate me for saying this, but if I'm going to listen to country music, it's usually like pop country and not like, you know, old school country. Our guitar player, Sam, like he loves real country music, you know?
Hank Williams, Johnny
and
Cash.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, these days listening to it just from a songwriter's perspective, I think that, you know, the new Dan and Shay album, which is very much pop country, is the best album of 2018, period.
I mean,
just like the songwriting on it from front to back is unbelievable.
I will have to check that out.
Yeah.
I've seen, as a DJ side gig situation, I see the Dan and Shay thing, and I know they're country. I just never have listened to it because usually when I play that stuff out that's not really what they're looking for.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, they've got a cool story too, man. Like, I grew up on this band from San Diego called My American Heart, and the bass player of that band plays for Dan and Shay. Mm. And then they've got a couple other guys in the band that, you know, kind of came from the scene. And so, just that crossover, I appreciate that. And they're, you know, they're a band that really deserves the success they're having.
Yeah.
I mean, incredible writers.
A lot of, it's crazy. I was thinking about this on the way over to pick you up too. Like, a lot of the bands in general from earlier on, like when early 2000s, when I first started, you know, really diving into like hardcore and metalcore and stuff like that, I never thought that these bands would continue on.
Yeah.
As like, you know, like they're never going to be like, I'm not going to go see the Allman Brothers at 15 and, you know, still be seeing them at my age now.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what's been going on. So that's cool too. And also those who didn't really make it further on in the industry are in music, as far as like an artist, definitely have found their little niche somewhere in the industry.
Yeah, totally.
A lot of people do studio musicians and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool to find out where everyone kind of,
it is cool,
the
man.
Chips fall. You know?
It is cool. Yeah. And I mean, just kind of seeing everybody's walks of life. You know, I've got friends that are like insanely successful real estate agents that, you know, started just playing in punk bands and stuff, you know? And, so it's cool, man. It's cool getting older and just kind of seeing everybody fit into their space, like you were saying.
Yeah. Like the, speaking of Texas, because you were talking, you brought up Dallas, the guy running in Texas, he was like a skateboarder, punk rock dude.
Yeah.
Right now he's running for office. So
that's so awesome.
Beto or something.
Yeah. That's so awesome.
So it's crazy how the times are definitely changing. So you originally from Spokane, were you doing music in Spokane?
Yeah. So I grew up in like a very musical household. My mom took us to concerts on the weekends instead of
mostly
sporting
grunge
events. Sorry?
Mostly grunge music and stuff like that?
Definitely when I was young, it was definitely the grunge era and it was sweet. You know, my brother and I were super into it, but, my family being like very conservative Christians and stuff, we would go to like, you know, conservative, like Christian concerts and maybe Reliant K if we got lucky or something. Right. But no, man, my older brother is a musician. My dad was a musician. So, just grew up around it and started performing on stage at the age of 6. And just started bands. My dad's neighbor had a son my age and he was a musician and they had built a band room for him. So we would go over there and just write songs and practice. And yeah, man, we started a few bands and had a good amount of success in the Northwest. Called it like the Northwest loop. You know, we would do like Seattle, Spokane, Portland, Salt Lake, you know, and that was all that we knew of the world.
Right.
But yeah, man, and I had a couple buddies from Spokane that pulled me aside. I was in a band called Nights in Fire and, we were currently planning on showcasing for, Solid State Records. And, I had a couple of buddies pull me aside that had moved out of Spokane and come back and were visiting and they had both had success in music. And they're like, listen, we want you to know, we think that you have something special and we've seen you grow up and we've seen how, you know, the gifts that you have. And you're not going to succeed if you stay in Spokane.
Yeah.
It's a trap. You know, like you'll continue doing the Northwest loop for the rest of your life. And, you know, we have had very little successful musicians. But the ones that we do have, I mean, Miles Kennedy is from Spokane, you know, and one of the best singers of our generation, period. And off the top of my head, that might be all I can think of, you know? So, you know, when I got the opportunity to audition for Memphis, I thought this was do or die, you know?
Yeah.
And, so my wife and I had been married for a year. We were 19 and we packed up our 4Runner and moved across the country and had never been to Texas. It was a huge culture shock, you know? But yeah, grew up in Spokane. I love visiting, but I am glad that I don't live there anymore.
You know, a lot of people, I have family that also live in Washington State too. So I haven't been there in 20 plus years, but you know, they seem to visit here a lot.
Yeah.
So that's all I have to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
You said you got married at 18.
Yeah, I got married at 18, man.
Is that, in hindsight, is that too young? Was it just right? Is that something, you know, I have a daughter, and if she told me she was getting married and she was 18, I'd be a bit,
absolutely.
About,
yeah, man.
Agreeing to
well,
that.
here's the thing. There's two sides to that. You know, we were both obviously at 17 years old living at our parents' houses, and, we took our parents out to dinner and we were like, hey, we want to get married. You know, a week after we graduate from high school. And my wife's mom was supportive and very, very cool about it. My parents were just, you know, we really want you to think about this, you know, as you get older, your taste might change a little bit. What you want now might not be what you want later. And if I was to give advice to most 18-year-olds in the world, I would say definitely don't get married at 18, you know? Because people do change a lot, and a lot of people don't really know exactly what they want at that age. Mm-hmm. But my wife and I have had an incredibly successful marriage, and I think a lot of that is due to the fact that, you know, having dated since we were, you know, 15 and then getting married at 18, we didn't bring a lot of previous relationship baggage into our marriage.
Drama and stuff.
You know, and our first time living outside of our parents' house was when we got our first apartment together. And so when you are single in your 20s and you're living on your own and you kind of get into your own process and you like the way that you're thinking, you have somebody else move into your space and you're like, whoa,
yeah.
This changes everything. I don't know if I like this. And for
this
us,
totally
we just don't,
dynamic.
You know, we experience so many first time things in life together. And I think that was very important to the success of our relationship. But you know, we both have, man, I think that we've gotten pretty lucky. You know, we love to be around each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's impossible for me to think about ever getting tired of my wife, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not that way for a lot of people, you know, and different people's love languages are different. So I think that getting married at 18 is scary for most people, but for whatever reason, it worked for us, man. And so
I can definitely see why it would be a little bit nervous. You'd be nervous about doing so, but you know, also, you got married a little early too, right, Alex, or no?
No, I mean, I was in my 20s, I think, but I did, you know, essentially marry, you know, my high school sweetheart.
Cool.
So, I mean, I've known her since I was 17. I mean, we weren't dating then per se, but so I've had more or less the same experience. But that's obviously it's worked out for you.
Yeah,
guys,
man,
so
it, absolutely.
Great.
And we've had friends that got married young and are already divorced and, yeah. And you know, and it's good. It's good because those, you know, like those relationships weren't right. You know, mm-hmm. They were poisonous for each other. And, I think it's just one of those things that maybe it's not an age thing. Maybe it's like you're just, you gotta try
luck,
and find
yeah.
out.
Yeah,
you know?
I think you either are lucky or you're not lucky or you make it work.
Yeah.
You
totally.
Know, cause unlike you both, I spent all my 20s, I should say, in a relationship, but not married. I've never been married before.
Yeah.
I didn't recently met the person I'm with, but you know, about a year and a half ago is when we started our relationship. But, yeah, I've done the entire 20s. I mean, you can live without a lot of it, you know,
yeah.
But it'd be cool to have spent a lot of that time in my 20s sharing memories and stuff like that with
sure.
someone
sure.
who I'm with now. But, cause you do find out when you get older that that's a little more endearing to your heart and, You like that kind
absolutely.
Of stuff more, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of clarity from life just comes with getting older. So many things that, like, my parents tried to, like, instill in me as a child, I was like, what? No.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, I get it.
Now I understand.
You know? Yeah, totally. I totally get it.
Now, how much has being a redhead been an impediment to you?
Dude, what?
Now, I ask because when I had, you know, a lot more hair, I was a redhead.
Really?
And, you know, it's funny. Yeah, it's funny. I have redheaded children. So, and my wife is redheaded.
I don't see
ginger
in your face.
I do have freckles. It's probably just this,
okay.
this light.
Yeah.
I had a ginger
afro.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Thankfully the term ginger didn't really exist
yeah.
when I was a kid, but I was bullied a bit with the old, you know, carrot
of top course.
Flare hair thing. But it's just funny because I see my kids now as they, you know, attend school, and now that ginger is such a prevalent
yeah.
thing, they say they're not getting bullied or anything like that. But I just always think like it's like a joke, you know, being a redhead when you talk about it superficially. But I guess out there somewhere there really are children who are super self-conscious
totally.
Why about that. And I think a lot of it has to do with your complexion, you know, if you're super freckly or, but it is, you're unique because I can't think of any other, metalcore bands with, the redhead
yeah.
singer. So I was really joking around if it's ever been a factor. In
well,
anything.
Yeah, it has, man. I mean, as a kid, I hated it, you know, and I dyed my hair black all the time when I was in like middle school and high school. But as at this point in my life and the career that I've had and kind of being in the public eye, it's been so helpful to just help me stand out.
Yeah,
you know,
out
in a scene where it's hard to stand out. There's so many bands like trying to do the exact same thing. And, I think that it's actually been a huge blessing in helping me stand out and giving me like, you know, a specific part of my image that people recognize, you know? Yeah. And I think that, you know, in this line of work, that's important. And so these days I'm super thankful for it.
Well, I mean, I always, when I was younger in school and stuff like that, I was always attracted to women with red hair.
Really?
Yeah. That's my little, like, that was my little go-to. I didn't end up with anyone with red hair, but you know.
Yeah.
It definitely was something that attracted my eye. So it's just because they're more, redheads are more rare.
Yeah.
Unless you're talking about Alex. He lives with the whole household of them, apparently. But, you know,
is your wife a redhead as well?
Yep. Cool. Yep. Wait, and so genetically, we were, it was a certainty that we would have redheaded children, I guess, because it's a recessive gene
yeah.
or whatever. But I think for females, it's kind of a, it's always been, let's see, perceived as a blessing. I know a lot of guys are into redheaded women, but I think it was tougher for
totally,
the boys.
Of course.
Whatever. I guess we all survived.
Yeah. No, you're right, man. It is. I mean, it's being different in any way in elementary school and middle school
is
the worst,
yeah.
dude. It's you just, instead of standing out for all the right reasons, you just become a target
yeah.
for the bullies, you know?
I have this weird stance with the bullying situation because, like, you know, we all, I mean, everyone our age now went through it at some point. But I also think, I don't want to talk out of turn. I think some of it is a little overblown too, and a lot of people just don't want to deal with bullying in general, which I agree that bullying is horrible for a lot of things. But it also does build your own character and help you find yourself a little bit going through some stuff like that too. But
yeah,
it's a give and take of, like, what's how much you're going to let good and how much you're going to let bad go. But,
you know, what sucks is just at a young age dealing with bullying, you don't know how to mentally process it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you either believe it, you know, believe what people are saying about you and just get depressed and,
yeah.
and feel just a complete lack of self-worth. Or you try to, you know, say like, yeah, you try to fight it.
Yeah.
You try to be the bigger bully in the situation. And that sucks too, you know? I think that just understanding mental health and understanding the way that things affect you at a young age should be something that's being taught in high school.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been much more important to me than math. I'll tell you that, like, right now, dude.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, you know, there's a lot of other stuff that I could have probably done in high school outside of learning, like, algebra 2.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you could get me with geometry. I could probably use geometry in my everyday life if I was doing, you know, woodwork or carpentry or some kind of building and needed to know radiuses and stuff.
But yeah.
Algebra 2, I've never even used Algebra 1
no. you know,
since then. So
no.
something weird that they teach in school.
Yeah, I flunked out of math for cheating. so and I think that
I definitely I wasn't a math whiz by any means.
Yeah.
But circling back, I do think it's a positive thing. You know, not enough is being done, but it's certainly a positive thing that we treat mental health and mental illness more seriously. I you know, as someone who has relatives who really struggled. You know, I feel sorry for anyone who's not of this generation because it was just swept under the rug. People self-medicated with alcohol. I just couldn't imagine trying to deal with that in an environment where people are not supportive, both doctors and family members.
Yeah, I completely agree, man. I mean, I see it in my own father and in my grandfather. I mean, they're inability to express the way that they feel about something or hiding it, you know,
mm-hmm.
I see that, you know, and it's, I feel so lucky to live in a generation where not only are, you know, the assets there, the resources are there for mental health, but also, I mean, like, genuine healing, like things that actually work,
mm-hmm.
you know, therapy saved my life. And I did EMDR therapy, which was developed for soldiers with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I mean, dude, it saved my life.
When you say
EMDR therapy,
explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, it was developed for soldiers with post-traumatic stress syndrome while you're sleeping at night. So when you go through things on a daily basis, like right now, the conversation that we're having,
right.
everything, we're experiencing it in our frontal lobe. If I touch this, like, I feel it and I experience it in my frontal lobe. And at nighttime, when you sleep, what happens is called rapid bilateral eye movement. Your eyes go left and right really quickly. And that physical motion takes things from your frontal lobe and it moves them to other parts of your brain where you can remember them, but you're not experiencing
okay.
them. When you go through something traumatic, oftentimes that memory gets stuck in your frontal lobe. And you go through life as if you're experiencing it on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every minute of every day. So I was in an airplane that everyone thought was going to crash. And for 2 years after that moment, when we landed from that flight, I never felt like we landed. I never felt safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had 2 years of that, and it spiraled into incredibly bad anxiety and depression. And so when you go into EMDR therapy, there's multiple different versions of it, but I did a lot of people just do one of them, but I did two at the same time, where you hold buzzers in your hands that go left and right, and you look at a dot on a screen that goes left and right, and you just start talking. You don't even have to necessarily talk about the traumatic situation, even though we did, and it does help. But you just talk about it, and there's these key points that come up. There's these things that you realize, and as you're realizing those things, your brain is literally connecting the dots. You know, anxiety is like, it's an alarm. And it's your body telling you something needs to be dealt with, you know? And so for me, this alarm was going off, but I didn't know what needed to be dealt with. I didn't understand it. And it wasn't until my brain started piecing the pieces of the puzzle together that it started to make sense to me. And then I finally had relief, you know? So it was life changing. And I think even just traditional therapy is amazing.
Yeah.
And you know, like the Hollywood perception of counseling being for people, or even like a psychiatrist or whatever, being for crazy people. I mean, that sucks, dude. Yeah. That sucks so bad. Even the term mental health or mental illness.
It just makes you sound a little off.
It makes you cringe, yeah. Dude. And it's like everybody you see is going through something.
Not one person has a perfect life.
No, but everyone in the world could benefit. You could have $1 billion in your bank account. You could, you know, be the most successful at this or that, and you could have a perfect marriage. You have the best upbringing, you know, like your parents never screwed you up or whatever, but it's like there's something there that needs to be dealt with. Because when you're growing up, there's too much that you're trying to process. And when you go through something traumatic, there's too much that you're trying to process, and you literally can't. You physically can't. And so you have to make that decision later in life to deal with those things that are affecting you on a daily basis. And I'm just lucky enough that my sister's a therapist and knew to tell me that I needed to do that, you know? But in high school, man, they didn't tell me anything.
And your guidance counselor didn't really tell you appropriately.
Guidance counselors, dude. I mean, I'm sure there's some great ones out there, but mine was a joke, dude.
I think most of them kind of were.
It was. Yeah. I don't even think she was a counselor.
Generally speaking, they
sucked. I don't think she was a counselor even. Yeah. I doubt that she had her degree.
Some teacher that just got lumped into that.
It's like community service for teachers. Yeah.
So that is.
Now, would you?
Sorry. Is that therapy? Sorry, is that therapy the one? Because you said it was also for people coming back from.
It was developed for soldiers with post-traumatic stress syndrome. Yeah.
Is that the one that they take like MDMA with, or because there is that?
No, that's completely different. No.
Okay.
Yeah, this is just it's literally just recreating rapid bilateral eye movement and moving memories from your frontal lobe to other parts of your brain. And it sounds so invasive, but it's not at all.
It's like some weird computer type stuff.
It's naturally doing.
Yeah.
You know, and so very important stuff.
So. I don't want to make you feel weird about it, but I do want to find out more about the plane that you were on.
Because
I hate flying myself. So I like to, for some reason, you like to stare at car crashes. If you hate car crashes, I like to hear about this kind of stuff.
Luckily, it's not bothering me. If we would have been, 3 years ago, my palms would be like dripping sweat right now and I'd be shaking. I flew from New Jersey to Orlando to track a guest vocal for a band. And the band had traveled down to Pensacola, and I was flying from Orlando back to Pensacola to meet up with the band the next day.
Not even a long flight.
It was less than 30 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not even long.
So we got to the airport. I got to the airport that I had stayed up all night with my producer, Cameron Mizell, and the flight was early. And I got to the airport, and all these people were like walking out onto the tarmac, and I'm like, what's this all about? And we get out there, and it's like this little 10-seat prop plane, because it's such a short flight. And I send a video to the guys, like a joke video of me walking on the plane. I'm like, pray for me, and we get up in the air. I mean, we're not even up for a minute yet, and the plane just starts, we go into a really bad storm, and the plane starts getting thrown to the left and the right 50 feet at a time. I mean, it was like, it was so violent. Mm-hmm. There's turbulence and then there's violence.
There's a difference between people who have ever only been
the
on
scarier
like,
the,
like,
the smaller the plane the scarier, for
bigger
sure.
planes.
Yeah,
you feel everything.
Like big commercial planes. Yeah,
or three or more rows of seats. But yeah, I went on
absolutely.
Something like that last year.
Absolutely. So, you know, we were up there and as soon as it started happening, I've never liked flying, but what I've always done is I've kind of just like scanned the room, right?
Yeah.
I'm like looking at people and what their reactions are. And businessmen who fly all the time and stuff like that, like they're usually very calm, mm-hmm. you know, everything. And everyone's like gripping for dear life and like shaking. And I see a lady next to me.
Yeah. You don't want to hear praying, that.
And then I look to my right and the flight attendant is holding on and she says, "Lord, help us." And at that point, my body was like shut down.
Yeah.
And I was like, not from the crew.
No.
Not from a flight attendant. Yeah. And so what I didn't realize was that in that moment, I had my first panic attack ever. But I didn't know. I had no idea. I'd never struggled with anxiety or anything until that point. So I didn't know what a panic attack was. I literally thought that we were going to die and my body felt like I was dying. Like I was in fight or flight, you know? And so, we landed, I mean, it wasn't, you know, even 20 minutes later and everyone's just like, got this like look on their face, you know, like what just happened to us. And I, as we touch the wheels, touch the ground, my body is like off centered and I feel like vertigo almost, but not like physical vertigo, like mental vertigo. Like I can't, my brain has not grasped something, which was safety. And the bus comes and picks me up at the airport and like everything just, I'm feel like I'm looking through a different lens. Yeah, at life.
You're just watching a movie.
It's weird, dude. Yeah. And, that night I woke up in the middle of the night covered in sweat, having no idea what was going on. And I kind of dealt with those symptoms for a while. And then we were back in Jersey and I was up in the front lounge and I was eating potato soup and I felt like a 747 was about to crash through the window. And I look around at everyone. I'm like, "Are you guys okay?" And they're like, "Yeah, what's wrong?" And I stand up and my heart's like, bum, 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 bum. And I go outside and I'm like just trying to catch my breath. And I walk into the bathroom in the venue because I'm thinking that I might just have like a stomach bug or something, you know? And I hear like an audible voice say, "You're not worth it. Kill yourself."
Oh, wow.
And I was like, "Whoa, what is going on? Like, this isn't me." You know what I mean? Like this, I don't go through whatever this is. And so I'm convinced at that point that I'm going to have a heart attack. So, they rush me to the hospital. And when we get into the waiting room, the doctor comes up and he puts his hand on me. He goes, "What's going on, son?" And right as he touches my body, all of those emotions just kind of like go and leave out of my feet. And I was like, "Okay." I was like, "I don't know what's happening. I think I'm having a heart attack." And he like asked me some questions about my lifestyle and what I do for a living and everything. And he's like, "I think you were having a panic attack. And I think that it's time that you slow down." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Well, that's not going to happen. So what else do you got, doc?" You know? And at that point in my life, I was treating my body so poorly. And, you know, so he gave me a bottle of Xanax, just like any good American doctor would do, you know? And, I went back to the bus and I took one and it didn't help. And I had 2 years from that point on where it got worse and worse and it got to, led to depression. And I felt like I would lay in bed at night and I could see this like dark figure standing over my body. And back then, you know, I'm a believer. That's like something that a lot of people know about me, about my faith and me being outspoken about that. So like, I was like relating it all to like demonic activity and spiritual warfare and, you know, having come out of it and come out on the other side and knowing what I know about mental health now. I think that the human body is just simply imperfect.
100%.
And I was going through something that was very scary and a lot of people go through it. And it's hard to say that I'm thankful to have ever gone through it, but I'm so thankful that I can understand what people are talking about when they say that they're going through
it. And also you're thankful to be on this side of it now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you consider yourself cured, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously anyone can relapse, but you're in a good place now.
I'm in a great place now. I'm in a really great place now.
I mean, you fly.
I fly. Yeah.
Have you flown on a smaller plane since then?
No, so I actually became status just shortly after that, became status with Southwest. They have one size of plane.
Oh, nice.
They only have like the 737 and the 747 or whatever. So like all my friends are like, "Dude, why do you care so much about Southwest?" And I'm like, "Shut up."
Yeah.
It's like very important to me. You know what I mean? So, you know, Southwest is awesome. And I mean, their pilots, you know, like I've done all sorts of research since that time. There's this rad website called askthepilot.com. And, it's just like all these resources for people who are like nervous about anything regarding airplanes. It explains turbulence and why it's not.
I honestly don't know if that even matters. So I think someone who is afraid of flying.
Yeah.
Will be afraid of flying.
Yeah.
Cause I have like, cause I've flown most of my adult life since I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm used to being on a plane, but that has no, that doesn't change the fact that, like, my first time on a 6-8-seater or whatever
yeah.
was insane. That's nothing like a regular plane that I was used to.
Nothing like
you,
it, yeah.
Like, when people, like you said, 50 feet one way, 50 feet the other way, like, I felt like the plane was on ice the entire time because the
Absolutely.
Plane just kind of moves in a weird way to where, like, diagonal yeah. and stuff. And that, like, you know, I was white-knuckling the thing. The
Absolutely,
whole time.
Yeah. No, it sucks, man. I think that different people perceive things differently. You know, my wife, like, loves adrenaline, like, loves roller coasters. And,
I mean, I can do that, too,
you know,
but
all that
it's
kind
something
of stuff.
About... Like, I could die up here.
Absolutely.
That's my thing.
But there is absolutely nothing natural about being 30,000 feet up in a steel tube.
You should be afraid of it.
Gravity
yeah.
is here for a reason. You know what I mean? And you should, I think that you have, people that are scared of flying have every right to be scared of flying, but I think that they do need to at least do the research to understand that some of the things that they might think is happening is not actually happening.
Right, right, right.
You know, the noises of, like, the landing gear that they make when you're sitting on the tarmac and all that kind of stuff. It's like, it's, you know, that website I was talking about is awesome for that, you know? And that way, when you start to freak out, you can just be like, yeah, I'm going to freak out, but I know in the back of my head that driving to Kroger is more dangerous than being in this
You've
airplane
heard
right now.
That. I've heard that my entire
yeah.
life, but I've never, I mean, I've been in a car accident. I've been in two car accidents, but,
yeah.
you know, I've survived two car accidents. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many plane crashes I'll survive. You know what I mean? So it's
yeah.
like,
well, you won't be in one because it's just statistically, so unlikely.
It is
and,
true.
And obviously that's the reason it is safer, but hey, at least you can still fly. Some people, you know, what was the football guy, John Madden.
Yeah.
I guess he's retired now, but he, in his heyday, was probably the most famous football announcer ever, but he was so scared of flying that he just couldn't do it. And he was doing these Monday night football gigs, which are obviously
on the bus
geographically all around the country, and would have to, you know, do it on the road.
Yeah.
Just drive there in his special tour bus or whatever.
Well, that's kind of cool in its own way.
It's kind of sweet. Yeah. I know, you know, Travis Barker doesn't fly anymore, I believe, after he like actually got in a plane crash. So
yeah,
like,
yeah.
rightfully so, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
You know
his
what I mean?
That
plane crash is a little different.
Yeah, but yeah, man, I mean, it's just, it is unnatural that we travel that way. But it's so much a part of my life that I don't have a choice.
Yeah. How often you guys must travel overseas and stuff like that?
We fly all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
So.
I just flew to Hawaii and back with my wife, a little over a week ago, and it's like 17 hours travel day each way, you know? So yeah, like you have to try to wrap your head around it. And yeah, but I still don't like it. I never have liked it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's funny, like there's
so
many different aspects of flying that people don't like. A lot of people are like, I feel crammed. I feel like in this space, I don't have a problem with that at all. You know, you put like a 700-pound dude next to me or whatever, I'm fine. You know what I mean? It doesn't mm-hmm. bother me. But other people are like, okay, well, we're over the ocean. So if we crash over the ocean, there's like nothing that we can't land anywhere. You know, that doesn't bother me at all. But literally, as the plane is ascending,
yeah.
you know, I'm like, this is not normal.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you feel that little like G-force of like when you leave the ground and
oh,
the
yeah.
plane's fully off the ground, you
yeah.
can tell. And it's just like, oh,
this machine is far too heavy to
this
float.
Is it. Yeah, this is it.
yeah.
This is how it goes down.
Yeah, yeah. This and I hope that me saying this crap doesn't like scare anybody or whatever, because that would suck.
You should
but
be scared of flying.
That's yeah, just,
I mean, you should be.
It's pretty wild that, you know, that we do that as human beings, that we travel through the sky. That's pretty wild to me.
And as frequently as we do.
Yeah.
You know, and I like you. Like you, I also like scan the room if like I hear like if there's a bump
yeah.
or something, I'm like, okay, I'll look around and okay, well they're still serving drinks.
Yeah,
that's
exactly,
not that bad.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? She's
exactly.
the one doing the pretzels, but
yeah.
you know, I can't even stand when they start easing off the throttle and the G-force just
yeah.
gives up on you a little bit, because I
yeah.
feel like, oh, I'm falling out of my chair, I'm falling out of the sky, I'm like freaking out. So.
That's, I mean, that's all so valid, man. I mean, that's, I know exactly what you're talking
over
about.
Over the oceans,
we've already ruined. Yeah. Already ruined the Guitar Center sponsorship. Now you're trying to ruin the JetBlue one. I think let's.
As long as it's not Southwest,
circle,
right?
Southwest, is, dude.
Yeah, I specifically did not mention Southwest.
They're a great airline, man.
But to go back to the band, for fear that we might spend the next 2 hours talking about flying because it's such an interesting conversation.
It really is. Yeah.
Admittedly, you've been in this band, or you've. Let's see, you're around, you're 30?
Yeah.
Is that right? So, has singing in a band been your only full-time job ever?
No. So, you know, I started working when I was 16. I worked at a movie theater. I worked at a postage meter company shipping supplies. I sold cell phones for Verizon. I worked at Hot Topic, was actually my first job ever. I worked at Guitar Center for a little while. I did a lot.
But those weren't full-time gigs, right? You were still in school.
At 16 and 17, no, but then at 18, yeah, at 18 I had three different jobs that were full-time, that not all at the same time, but I had okay. gone through three different jobs that were full-time, and then even moving to Dallas and joining the band, I'd worked at Guitar Center for a little while when I was there. And then once the band started touring full-time, it's been about 11 years and yeah, it's been my main source of thing. You know, I started a hair product company a few years ago as well, but yeah, yeah.
Do you think you could go back to that sort of life? Our last interview was with, Mark of Vale of Maya, and he more or less said he doesn't know how he'd survive doing a regular,
monotonous 9-to-5
job.
No, I couldn't. There's no way. And I wouldn't, you know. I think that, there's a very good chance I won't be playing music forever, you know. Not very many people get that opportunity, but, I just have too much of an entrepreneur mindset, and you know, obviously with my hair product company, but also just I would much rather or much sooner go and like work with a label or like work with a booking agency or do something that like remains in music rather than like going back to like a straight up like desk 9-to-5 job or whatever. You know, I would still need to travel and I would still need to be involved in a creative process one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Sorry. This happens a lot when I'm on the phone because I can't interpret the natural tenor of the room in which to interject. Now I was going to ask about, as I usually do, just looking around the internet, and it had mentioned that the single you guys wrote, you know, I suppose early, I think it was on the Challenger album, Prove Me Right. According to Wikipedia, was about Trustkill Records, mostly, your first label. And I couldn't find any further information, you know, about that. I was just looking, for some background because obviously Trustkill has been was, it's not around anymore, but Trustkill in the early 2000s was one of the iconic metalcore labels. And, I was just curious to know more about that, your experience with Trustkill. Obviously you guys have been with Rise Records for a while now, but.
Yeah, I you know, like we had signed to Trustkill at a very unfortunate time. There was so much drama surrounding the label and the other artists on the label. And because of that, you know, we didn't get some of the opportunities that we should have gotten at that stage. And so it was a tough time to be signed to Trustkill for sure. Josh and I, Josh, the owner of the label, he and I still talk all the time, and there's no bad blood there, but in that season, trying so desperately to succeed in music and only wanting that and then having someone kind of essentially standing in your way, was extremely frustrating. And there was definitely some fuel to the fire in that song. Yeah.
Okay. And the band, the power structure in this band, I'm just curious because you're the, I suppose the figurehead. Everybody, when they think of Memphis Mayfire, probably thinks of you. You're not an original member, obviously. I think Kellen's the only original member.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean,
so who calls the shots in the band? Is it a democracy or is it like Kellen's the boss or Maddie's the boss?
Kellen is very gifted as a writer. You know, Kellen is like insanely talented. More so than I think people understand or give him credit for, you know, like he's brilliant. And when it comes to the business things, I've just always naturally gravitated towards that thing, those kind of things anyways. So, you know, the way that we are structured is that, you know, I deal directly with management and we make a lot of decisions like on a daily basis. And, whenever there's something that really does require the group to get involved, you know, like we'll bring them all in on an email, obviously, but the guys are pretty much used to just like decisions being made and then they get an email and that's it, you know, but, neither I nor management would ever make a decision that would, you know, that would put anyone in a bad situation or do something that they didn't want to do. Having been in the band for 11 years, like we know these guys well enough that when we're, you know, negotiating for tours or talking about what kind of transportation we're going to be on for a certain tour, I pretty much know exactly what everyone is wanting and looking for, you know? So, you know, it's healthy. It's healthy the way that we have it.
Now for you, since you've released a couple solo albums or two solo albums, right? Or is it
yeah,
just one?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Is it harder to create an album as a solo artist or in a band? On one hand, you have input from other individuals, but I suppose it's some, on some level, that's a curse more than a blessing.
Dude, it's much harder to create an album as a band than it is as a solo artist, but let me say this. I'm embarrassed of a lot of those songs on my solo albums, you know? Because I didn't have the outside input of people being like, yo, dude, this needs to change. You know? It was just me and a producer and a budget, and I was like, cool, and I was like feeling something in the moment. I think this is rad! And then we put it out, and then like a few years later, I'm like, oh,
well, you grow and mature in general, so you probably feel the same way about Memphis May Fire stuff.
Absolutely,
too,
you know, so. Older Memphis stuff, absolutely. But, you know, like having the input of other musicians that I really respect, and it can get really annoying and frustrating at times, but it's healthy, and it really is valuable, you know? Mm-hmm. I wish that there would have been more people involved on that first solo record I did.
More, less yes men, so to speak.
I had like literally just one yes man and a budget, and that was it. That was the whole team. So it's like whatever we come up with today, that's how it's going on the record.
So how are you gonna, if you do another solo album, is that you're gonna make a concerted effort to have more opinions, to get additional perspectives? How are you gonna sort of
on my
counter
second
that?
On my second solo record, it's called Unstoppable. The it's the last one I put out. I co-wrote every song on the record. So I knew after the first one that that's what I wanted to do. And living in Nashville, I mean, it's so easy to, you know, like the assets are everywhere.
Yeah.
So I just wrote with people that I respected, people that I knew of, that I had heard of. And it was awesome. It was an awesome process. And even looking back since that record, I'm like, man, I wish I would have done things just a little differently, but it's far less embarrassing than my first effort for sure.
Well, you also don't know how it's perceived in general the first time around.
Yeah.
How come that album didn't come out? The second album didn't come out on Rise.
Well, because that project is like very much heavily aimed towards Christian radio, and Rise doesn't have anyone in office that like services to Christian radio or really even understands that market very well. And they were fully aware of that, and they were supportive of whatever I wanted to do, which is so cool. It's so cool of them. You know, I look back at like that first record that I put out on Rise, and like they should have been like, dude. Don't put this out, man, especially on Rise. Like, what are you doing? But they were like, Maddie, whatever you want to do, we support it, you know? And that's been so cool.
Hey, it did pretty well, did it not?
Yeah.
Rise should have made some money on that thing.
Yeah, man. I think that they did. And I think that for how wildly outside of the realm of Memphis's music it is and was, I think people were, you know, for the most part, like, pretty supportive of it, you know, like they're like, that's cool, even if they're like, that's not for me, but cool that you're doing that. So yeah, man. So I signed for my last record to a label called BEC, and they're like the Christian radio branch of like Tooth and Nail Solid State Records.
Interesting. So to you, are you do you write the lyrics for Memphis May Fire all yourself, or is that like a co situation?
Okay. Yeah, always have.
So that leads me to my next question, because you kind of just brought up the whole religious radio and, and Christianity and stuff like that. So how does your upbringing with your mom and dad and your family and just the way you grew up, does that in your faith, does that cross over into your music a little bit, or
Absolutely.
Do you try to separate the two?
Absolutely, man. Yeah. It does, especially, I mean, with the band and with my solo stuff. It's funny because In Memphis's music, there's always been like a spiritual undertone, just because it's always been such a big part of my life. But when I started going through anxiety and depression and really like seeking after God for the first time in my life and like trying to understand who He really was in my life, I just started to be more outspoken in interviews about my faith. And so when we put out Unconditional, that album is like, you know, half about what it's like to have a panic attack and half about what it's like to believe that you're loved by the supernatural creator of the universe, which mm-hmm. doesn't make for a great metal album, you know what I mean? So our fans were just like confused, I think, but it's funny, like you look back at like what gave us our start, you know, like that song The Sinner, and it's like that song is so much heavily about my faith, you mm-hmm. know? And so I think it's like it was just when I started talking about it in interviews that people were like, whoa.
What's going
on here?
Don't
shove that down my throat. And I'm like, I'm like this is literally all I have to offer, because it's what I'm going through in my life, you know?
It's also kind of strange too, because there's a lot of bands, you know, and a lot of bands could be listening in as well, but a lot of bands that are out there, like August Burns Red and stuff like that, that are, you know, they're a Christian metalcore band too. So it's weird to find a balance between, like you said, just it being a part of the persona and everything like that, and I guess people that aren't religious to have it shoved down their throat. So
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, dude, Wikipedia says that we're a Christian band, and that's not the case at all. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I've never once.
Well, we were going to ask that too.
No, yeah, I've never once claimed that all my band members have the same beliefs as me, nor have I ever asked them to. I don't, you know, or forced anything on them at all. They're good guys, and they stand behind me in whatever it is that I'm going through, in whatever season of my life that I want to talk about. And so, you know, the internet just calls us a Christian band, but that's not the case at all.
Now, your father was a pastor, right?
He was.
Was Wikipedia correct in that sense?
Yeah. Does Wikipedia still say that I'm the keyboardist of Memphis Mayfire?
Because... No, I didn't see that.
Yeah. Okay.
So how did your dad feel? You know, you tell your dad you're joining a metalcore band, which I you know, metal typically would be a genre perceived as being, you know, full of sinners, for lack of a more elegant, eloquent way of putting it.
Totally.
What was your dad's reaction?
Dude, my dad's cool, man. So, he definitely didn't understand the music aspect of it, you know, and I get that question all the time, like, man, my parents don't get it. What do I do? And I'm like, let them not get it.
Yeah.
That's okay. If I have kids, I'm going to hate what they listen to as well.
It's just going
to happen. You know
what
I mean?
Yeah.
It's going to happen. No one's going to understand the next generation of music. Like, even right now, dude, like all that like mumble rap crap
Baby
that's
Shark
out there, dude, like is so offensive to me. I'm like, this is not music. You know, I'm sure that my kids will listen to something in that realm or whatever. So I get it. And I never blame my parents for not like totally understanding the music. But now fast forward all these years and them having like supported me in my career and them like listening to the bands that we tour with and everything, they're our biggest fans now, dude.
Yeah.
Like they love our records. And so, you know, but my dad, man, there's a lot of really awful religious people. And I think that people who hate religion don't hate God. I think they hate Christians, and rightfully so. There's
a
lot
of... I think they hate the persona that they perceive in their head.
Absolutely, yeah. Man. I mean, there's been more Christians that have drugged the name of Jesus through the mud than atheists, period, mm-hmm. You know? But what Jesus does ask of us in the Bible, like the foundation of who Jesus was and what he asks of us, is to love people. And not to go and love Christians,
mm-hmm.
But to go and love people in the darkest places, you know? And I think that a lot of people come out to metal shows and come out to hardcore shows, because it's a place where they fit in, where they don't feel like they fit in anywhere else in the world. And it's like, man, if I get to talk to an entire crowd of people who feel broken in their core and just love on them, I'm doing the work of God,
mm-hmm.
Period.
Yeah.
And that's awesome to me. And so my dad never expected me to go and to play for Christians only, you know? But he's the kind of guy that has a really good head on his shoulders, and he understands the gospel the way that it's meant to be understood.
Yeah. I grew up in a kind of Catholic background too.
Okay.
I'm no longer religious, so to
sure,
speak.
Sure. Yeah.
However, I do have like a relationship with the universe,
sure.
You know, like, and I think that kind of all boils down to somewhat in the same realm.
Sure.
You know, it's a belief or a faith in something,
yeah,
or another. But, did you find that when you started, like, when you started becoming more vocal about your stuff, whether in the lyrics, did you find that your fan base followed you, or did you kind of started getting another type of fan base? Or
that's a good question, man. I think that, yeah, definitely a mix of both. I think that, you know, when there's interviews on YouTube of me like talking about my relationship with Jesus, obviously there's like Christian soccer moms that are like, all right, I'll take you to that show. You know what I mean? So I think
you made the newsletter this week.
Yeah. So I think that we did gain kind of that, you know, like the four today following, so, you know, so to speak. And that's cool, man. And we're so thankful for that. And I think that there's a good amount of Memphis fans that were like, you know, I mean, I just like the way your music sounds. You know
yeah.
what I mean? Talk about whatever you want. And then there's people who, you know, who are like so offended by it. And I'm never offended by somebody being offended at me talking about religion, because it's like, man, if religion or if God or if Christianity offends you, then that means somebody hurt you.
Yeah. Or there's some other situation going on within your personal
yeah.
life.
Yeah. And I don't blame you for feeling that way. I mean, dude, a lot of the people that I know that like hate the church were burned by the church in a way that I don't know if I would have come back from either.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I get it. And I don't hold that against them at all. But regardless, my faith is such an important part of my life that I'm not going to not talk about it,
mm-hmm.
just because it offends somebody. You know, my relationship with God and him walking through that season of anxiety and depression with me is so incredibly valuable to me that I would feel worse about withholding that information from people.
Mm-hmm.
You can do whatever you want and you can believe whatever you want. And I'm not here to force anything down your throat, but this is my story and it's important that I tell it honestly.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
Now for the people, the, I guess the other members of your band or the label Rise Records, you know, is that a conversation that's had, you know, for commercial reasons, Maddie, we'd like you to tone down the religious rhetoric. It's not doing us any favors. We support your beliefs, but just don't talk about it.
Yes.
Is that the kind of thing that's happened?
Yes, absolutely. It has.
And what's your response to that? You stand firm, or it's like, I'll give in a little bit
in the season, in the season that I was in when that conversation, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's my fault.
In the season that I was in, and that's never come from the band members, you know, but the season that I was in when that conversation was had originally, it was, it's my faith or I'm out. You know, like I felt such a calling. I felt such a responsibility to be 100% honest and not hold anything back in that season. That my response was like, find another singer, you know, because it would be such a disgrace for me to go through something so powerful and to not tell people about it just because we want to sell more records, you know. And
it's
I understand.
It's weird seeing both sides of it.
I do understand where people are coming from. Like, this is a business, you know, and I understand the business aspect of music. Trust me, but. In that point of my life, the conviction was far outweighed the business, far outweighed the money, the success.
A lot younger time too, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
You were younger.
I was. I mean, you know,
you're steady. You're more like to hold your ground, so to speak, and not really.
Totally. And I definitely was offended. You know what I mean? Yeah. I was offended and I was hurt because I had people that were on my team, so to speak, that I thought were there through that, you know.
Not letting you be you.
Not letting me be me. But I mean, dude, it's, you know, like that's long gone. And we have a great support system with our record label, and the guys in my band are awesome. And, you know, we went through those seasons and we got through them. So,
you brought
as your, has your, sorry, I have so many questions. I know.
Go ahead.
I'm overbearing. Has your, you know, you talked about the conviction you had then, insinuating that, while you still have the conviction, perhaps you're not as, you know, adamant about it. So has that, you know, have you toned down, that, sorry, I didn't have a fitting end to that sentence. Have you toned down your approach, because you are older, more mature and period?
Yeah. So, in that season when I was writing those records, it was very important, and I think that it was very important that those records come out. And as I stepped into the writing process for this record, for our new one, for Broken, I just had some moments with God. I just had some moments in prayer where I was like, God, what do you want me to write about? I've written about this, I've written about that, my relationship, my faith, my this, that, a lot of the music industry stuff that I've been through, and I really felt this clear mission for this record to not be it. I felt like God was saying, when you were at your worst with anxiety and depression, it didn't help for someone to come tell you, hey, everything's gonna be okay, hey, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, a pat on the shoulder.
It is important for you to realize, but in that moment you're never going to realize that, you know what I mean?
No, absolutely. But yeah, I always felt this need to make our music really hopeful, you know, to always offer a light at the end of the tunnel, to always offer hope, because I felt like if there people were listening to our music and they were feeling hopeless and I wrote a song that felt hopeless, that I was making the problem worse. But the first time that I ever felt any relief with anxiety was when I was listening to a CD that was a microphone in the middle of a room with a bunch of people sitting around it talking about what it's like to have a panic attack. And that was not hopeful at all. Mm-hmm. But what it gave me was this reassurance that I wasn't alone in it. You know, that other people understood what I was going through and that I wasn't going crazy. So I wanted this record to be specifically, it's called Broken because it's for broken people. And I think we're all broken in one way or another, you know?
Find someone unbroken, they're a liar.
but that's what the record is. I wanted it to be full of anthems for people that were going through seasons of life that were painful and they didn't know how to voice it. And I wanted these songs to be their songs, you know? And so it's not necessarily that I've toned down the spirituality of my lyrics, or that I've even stepped away from faith at all, or that I've matured out of it or anything like that. It's really just that I felt like God wanted me to write a record that was honest about what it's like to be hurt. Because that's what
people
need.
You were friends with, I don't know that you are, but you were, I want to say close or somewhat close with Matty Montgomery before today. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, we did a couple tours together, and we had some really valuable conversations. You know, this was years ago.
What was your perspective when he, you know, obviously he took a lot of flack, I'll say, particularly in the online metal music world. And, you know, my site was one of those that sort of, I guess, cast it in a negative light, for better or for worse. But I'm just curious for you as a bystander to Matty going through that, for presumably saying what he firmly believed in, catching so much flack.
Yeah, man. I have a lot of respect for Matty as a person. I love that dude. He's got a good heart, and he's been a huge encouragement to me over the past 4 or 5 years. I will say that Matty and I have two different types of ministry, so to speak. You know, like, he feels very convicted to get in front of a group of people and like straight up like lay down the gospel, like in like a loud manner. And I just really believe that if my beliefs are something that someone else is interested in, I think that that's because I've loved them, that they trust me first. You know,
you're a little more comfortable with them.
Totally. Yeah. I want to stand outside. If people want to talk to me about my relationship with God, I want to stand outside of the bus after the show and have them just straight up ask me questions, and I'll answer them. But if I've ever come off preachy on stage or whatever, if I've ever been like saying something on stage that felt like I was like being preachy or forceful, it was really just me talking to myself, figuring things out in my head, you know? And so, you know, we do things differently, Matty and I. But I respect him, and who he is and what he believes and how he preaches, you know, that's his thing.
All right. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
You brought up.
I also wanted to ask, sorry, last question, David, that I'll just plow straight ahead.
Go ahead.
The whole Tyler Carter thing, Tyler of Issues, I guess they wrote a song, and the quote I read, he said, I'm, you know, really good friends with Matty, but, the quote I have it in front of his personality called is about Matty Mullins or people who put their fame above others' place or purpose in life. And when I remember when that happened, and I was sure that fame was a mistake and the word should have been faith. And I did a little more research, and it seems like every place I found that quote, it said the word fame, which was confusing to me. Is that accurate? He was calling out your fame?
Yeah.
Or your desire for fame, I suppose?
Dude, I mean, I was just as confused and caught off guard by the whole thing as you are. I mean, it was like the strangest. Honestly, dude, I think it was just like a desperate reach for a song concept. I mean, like, Tyler and I had spent time together, and I mean, like, we never had any feud or anything like that. So it was just like, it caught me off guard. It was so strange. I was like, really? I was like, you felt so strongly about something that you and I have never talked about? That you needed to write a song about it? Like, what are you talking about?
So he never approached you or had...
Not once,
he never,
dude, no.
Gave you a heads up, nothing.
No,
it's just all of a sudden there's this song.
Any conversation whatsoever about that, or really anything deep for that matter ever, you know? So it was weird, dude. And we had a text conversation after that. It was basically just me being like, are you serious? Like, if you had some sort of issue with like the way that I did anything, which I'm still confused about, why wouldn't you call me? You know, like if we're friends, you know, if that's the beginning of the statement, why wouldn't you call me, or why wouldn't you text me? And so that we could clear things up. Instead, you know, like let's take this thing that's fictional and create a song out of it, you know?
Was that the end of the friendship?
We haven't had much interaction since, no. Yeah, it was strange, man. That was a strange one. And I think that me being a Christian, right, it's like I'm an easy target. You know what I mean? Like people are like always waiting for me to like do something or like say something that they can be like, told you.
Call you
know?
On
yeah.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like it doesn't really like surprise me anymore. But man, I've made some really big mistakes, like really big, you know. I was young and we were on Warped Tour, and we had this song called Jezebel that was like just about like girls, groupies that were like trying to like, you know, come in on the camp and like whatever. And And I thought, man, what if I say, like, before this song, like, this song is for the sluts or the whores or whatever, you know? And, like, that word is going to make the crowd go crazy, and it's going to be so, like, you know, like, edgy and all this. And then, like, all of a sudden, this, like, you know, this group of I think it was, like, a feminist group or whatever was at the show, and they had, like, come at me on the internet. And I was, like, in that moment, dude, like, I was, like, whoa, what did I do?
Mm-hmm. I remember Joel from the Amity Affliction calling you out.
Yeah, and
did you guys ever have a conversation afterwards?
No, never. And I mean, things are obviously fine these days, you know, so sure. long ago. But when I think about saying that on stage, I get sick to my stomach.
Yeah.
I'll admit all day long that was the most immature, most like cowardly way to get a response out of a crowd. And it's not the aftermath of it. The effect of it is not at all
worth it.
What I thought was worth it, or what I thought was going to come of it, you know? So it's like, you know, there's bands that are like very outspoken, offensive bands that like will never take any heat for saying anything even remotely close for that.
But
And that's not an excuse at all. I mean, what I said was awful, dude. Right. At that time in my life, like I didn't mean for it to feel the way that it felt to certain people, mm-hmm. you know? And I, dude, if I could take that back all day long.
Even though the climate's changed too since then too. Like the social climate.
Totally. Has changed too. Yeah, so absolutely.
Even bands that are more known to be more vulgar and
absolutely.
They're changing their tone.
Absolutely.
Too.
Yeah. I mean, dude, I was like, my saying that was like to a person that wasn't in the crowd. You know what I mean? Or in any crowd, but then people in the crowd felt like attacked.
Right.
And that, dude, what a bummer. You know what I mean? And so I don't know if that song had anything to do with that moment or whatever when the whole internet wanted to crucify me. You know what I mean? But, I was so thankful for, you know, AP did an interview and they were like, hey, we want to know if you have something to say about this. And I was like, I would love to clear the air. Mm-hmm. Nobody read it. You know what I mean? Because nobody reads the apology or whatever. Everyone just like reads the, you know, whatever. But no, I mean, people that attack me on the internet or people that come at me are people that have never taken time to ask me a question or to get to know me or whatever. And that's usually not the way the internet works. People are usually like voicing their opinions before they get to know somebody or whatever.
And also, I mean, like you, like you said, you put yourself out there.
Yeah.
Not only that, but you have your religious views or your
totally.
Life views.
Yeah.
Then you're in a band.
Yeah.
On top of that. So there's a couple other things.
Totally.
Everyone's got an opinion.
Absolutely.
Everyone has an opinion.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, man. Yeah. No, but that, you know, that I haven't even, to be honest, I haven't thought about that song in so long. And I actually never even listened to the song because I was like, this is a joke. but yeah, man, no, it's weird. It's strange, man. It's such a strange thing, you know, growing up in the spotlight and making friends in music and then like going through something really tough and having made a mistake and definitely deserving some flack for it. Absolutely. But when your own friends, quote unquote, mm-hmm. like are just there to grab the torch and to be another person that stabs you in the back because it's an opportunity to gain some numbers, mm-hmm. you know? That sucks, dude.
A lot of things are for clout.
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks to like to wonder who you can trust or who's really even like cares, you know? Because I had a very small amount of people that would come up to me and be like, dude, why'd you say that? Or did you mean that? You know, like none of that. It was just like, oh, this is the person that everybody hates right now. Let's do it, you know? And
you're lucky that it probably didn't happen in this time for the internet.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
You probably got crucified way worse.
Absolutely, you know? Man. Yeah, no, and it sucks. It sucks growing up in the spotlight and making dumb decisions and regretting them. But I mean, that's all part of what we do, mm-hmm. you know?
So, what do you think the biggest misconception about you is, if you had to pick one?
That I'm religious. I think the biggest misconception about me is that I'm religious. I think that people see me like at church, like, you know, like doing this or whatever. The church that I attend in Nashville is like the most incredible, open, honest conversation that I get to attend every week. That's so wonderful. And I genuinely believe that people are all on an equal playing field. And a lot of like the rules and regulations that people think about Christianity are so false and not the character of Jesus at all. I'm so thankful for my relationship with God and because of the freedom that it gives me, not the restrictions that it puts on my life. And the guidance, absolutely. I think that what God desires for his children is to follow a path that's going to bring them joy, that's mm-hmm. going to bring them happiness. You know what I mean? I'm thankful for my morals and things that came from scripture, like not cheating on my wife out on the road. Because ultimately, whatever temptation I might experience in a moment is far outweighed by the richness of my relationship with my wife right. that I've had for 13 years. You know what I mean? And so I'm so thankful for that. But I'm, you know, like the Old Testament law, and even, I mean, like the misconception of New Testament and who God is and who Jesus was at heart, it is, makes me far from a religious person. You know, I believe I have a relationship with the creator of the universe, and it's so rad. That's awesome to me. But I'm far from religious.
So you've been with your wife 13 years.
Yeah.
You kind of, I don't want to say like made it sound like it's pretty easy for you and her to continue being in a relationship.
It's the hardest thing to say about our marriage, but it is true.
Okay.
I feel like we've had a fairly easy time.
Yeah. Do you think that, and she may join you on the road sometimes, I'm assuming too, but do you think having the ability to be apart for some time helps or hinders that?
People, I think that that's a pretty common thing that people think about our marriage, you know, is like, oh, absence makes the heart grow fonder. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say that's the case at all. We definitely miss each other like crazy. And there's definitely those like really powerful, sweet moments, like right when you right. come home. Absolutely. But man, I mean, we spend a lot of time at home together too. We don't tour nearly as hard these days. We tour a lot smarter than we do harder these days. And our time at home together is fruitful. Dude, it's not that we don't argue, that we don't get into like tough stuff, but like working through it, we enjoy. Mm-hmm. It's not work because we love the sweet, the good moments so much that doing the work to get back to that kind of thing, man, it feels like a luxury. You know, to be able to work on something that you, with someone that you love and respect so much is a joy, you know? Cool. And so that's how we perceive it. And I guess, you know, we're just lucky.
That's pretty interesting. I want to kind of dive back into like you moving down to Dallas and the band and stuff like that. You've moved from Spokane to Dallas. The band's writing records and stuff like that. You guys are making music in Dallas, and then you move to Atlanta.
Yeah.
You said? Mm-hmm. Does the sound change with the band with the moves? Because I only ask because you kind of already elaborated that you like the South as well.
Yeah.
As far as like demographically.
Totally.
But musically, it's a lot different too. Like we do have a lot of Southern rock, metal, Southern twang type
stuff. Totally, yeah.
And your earlier stuff as a band was more along those lines of like, you know, when the influx of metalcore, Southern metalcore came out.
Yeah.
You guys were kind of in that ballpark.
Yeah.
And now I'm just curious how the music, is the location of you guys living, has that changed the sound of it, so to speak? Or is it
I don't know,
like
man. It's tough to say
older?
Because like as the years passed, we were moving. So it's like, was it the environment or was it the fact that I was just getting older?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. Living in Seattle at a time in my life when I was depressed and anxious was an awful decision. I mean, there's no worse weather or like, you know, like type of city to be around when you're going through something like that. And that definitely played a role in how I was writing at that time frame. But I don't know, you know, living in Atlanta, Dallas, Seattle, Nashville, I feel like I can't say that the areas that we lived in ever really affected the music that much, you know? And it's only Kellen and I that write, just mm-hmm. the two of us. So yeah, and I think that no matter where we live in the South, I'll always be a boy that grew up in the Northwest, you know? And I think that that comes out of me more than anything.
So we're not expecting like a full-on country album coming out?
I don't think I have it in me, man.
Just no. Because, you know, you guys are living in Tennessee and Nashville.
Yeah, man. I think our guitar player, Sam, will absolutely put out a country record one day. And we'll all be there to support him. Absolutely,
nice.
Yeah. Because he loves it and he was raised with it, you know. But none of us were. None of the other guys were, so.
So I have some people wanted to know some things. You brought up Sinner earlier, so that was
Sinner,
that was one of the questions. Someone would like to know undisclosed in uncensored stories and inspirations or motives that were for the songs like The Sinner, No Ordinary Love, or Vices. So if you want to do all three of them or just one
That's
of
awesome,
them,
man.
One
the
welcome
Sinner
to.
Is literally was an outcry from me to God being like, I need you. Keep me close, keep me close, keep my head above water. I can't do this on my own is the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was an outcry from me to God being like, listen, I fully understand that like this is too much and I need you. I need your guidance. The Sinner. Vices. Not directly related to me, but to very close friends and family that we have seen, with substance abuse just genuinely take over their lives and turn them into different people. And I think that that's a very powerful concept. I think that a lot of people struggle with substance abuse.
Well, I think a lot of people can relate to either knowing somebody. Because I think nowadays, I think everyone has like one person at least in the family or friend zone.
Yeah, either going through it or having family or friends that are going through it. I mean, you understand the severity of it. So that's that song. And what was the third? No Ordinary Love. So there's a story in the Bible called, you know, about the prodigal son, someone who, you know, had a father who was, you know, very wealthy and gave part of his inheritance to a child, and the child ran off and spent it all and then came back. And when he came back, the father was there with open arms. Like, I forgive you. It doesn't matter what you've gone and done. I don't see that part of you. I just love that you're here and wanting to be with me. Mm-hmm. And that was me and my relationship with God earlier on, growing up in the church and then starting the band thing and kind of straying from that a bit and then coming back through my anxiety and depression and like seeking God's heart, coming back and desperately just wanting to get back to who I used to be and God being like, you know, that's amazing. I'm here and I've been waiting for you, cool. You know? So that's what that song is.
Awesome. Were you always wanting to be in a band? Like to front a band, were you always wanting to do that? And did your, you know, cause my question, like, I don't get to sit down with a lot of like, Christian bands per se.
Sure,
so
yeah.
I get, I have a lot of questions that kind of pertain to that, but I'm trying not to make it all about that either.
No, sure. Yeah.
But like, were you always thinking like, you know, I want to be in a band and I want to be, well, obviously you had like the battle between like your views and your lyrics and stuff like that. So, was it always like a goal for you to be in a band like that, or did it something that happened and like you said, you strayed a little bit? So did you come back to it? And you know, curious to how that goes because I was
singing and performing at the age of six. I always knew that, you know, like for me, the bands that were really influential in my childhood were bands like DC Talk and Audio Adrenaline and you know stuff like that. So I was going to those shows and always from the time that I could speak, I was singing. And I always wanted to front a band. Mm-hmm. Always. I've literally never known anything else. And so getting into high school and then like the Tooth and Nail Solid State era kind of sweeping in and like being very influential to me, bands like Blindside and Showbread, and I was so drawn to it. And so earlier on in my career with Memphis and starting bands and everything, it was very much about having success in music. I had something I wanted to say. I wanted people to listen. I wanted to play shows. I wanted to sell merch. I wanted to travel. I wanted to tour in a bus. I wanted to see the world, you know.
All the perks, yeah.
All of my focus was right there, you know. And so getting to a point in our lives where we had experienced so much of that and it wasn't as fulfilling as I thought it was going to be, and then mix in with that all the anxiety and the depression, it was definitely a season of growth for me.
Okay.
It was a season where I was like, man, I need to get back to the heart of why I love music. I need to get back to the heart of why I'm here, why I think that I have been given this opportunity, this platform, and I want to make sure that I'm using it for the right things, you know? And that was that season for me.
Interesting, so, yeah. What is your favorite Memphis May Fire record that you guys have done collectively? Is it the newer stuff or is it the older stuff? Or
we have our newest record is always going to be like our favorite record of that time because it's fresh and it's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get away from that.
But the record that stands out to me the most, and I think always will, is Unconditional. I don't know if I'll ever go through a season as tough as I was when I wrote that record. And I think that it was so hard to make that album, and it was so scary to make that album. It took a lot of courage, and it took a lot of strength. And I think that I can't force a season like that to happen. So when we make our next record, I might be in a great spot and we're writing music to write music because we're in a contract and we have to, you know? And that's not to say that it doesn't mean something to us, that it's not valuable to us. But you know, in that season, when I was talking to my sister, who's the therapist, and I was like, I genuinely believe that when people looked up to me, if I told them that I was going through something that it was going to ruin something for them, that they're going to be like, oh my gosh, if he's struggling, then, you know, we're all doomed because I really thought that he had it all together. And man, that was so poisonous, you know?
But I mean, I think a lot of people always will think that so-and-so has it all together. And that's why, you know,
totally.
Things like you talking about your anxiety and just like hating flying or your religious views and stuff like that, it also opens you up to people that are like, oh, okay, well, it's also okay to have these issues.
And that's so important. It really is so important. And my sister told me, she's like, what those people need more than anything is to know that you struggle just like they do.
Yeah, because you're in a position of like,
absolutely.
That's celebrity status, but you're out there. You put yourself out there in the world and the industry and the music and the Instagram and Twitter and all that.
Totally.
Stuff,
so. Yeah. So I was fearful about it. You know, I was fearful about being honest and like really just wearing my heart on my sleeve with that record. And it was so rewarding to talk to the people that were positively affected by that record and to know, like to look people in the eyes and to have gone through what they're going through in that moment, and for them to say that that song helped them through it, was the, maybe the most rewarding part of my whole career.
Cool.
And so, yeah, I think Unconditional will always probably be my favorite record.
What's the worst record or song that you guys have made, song that you've made that you have to play out, I should say?
Yeah, I don't know.
One,
dude.
One that the crowd may like a lot, but the band is like, oh, that one again, huh?
Yeah, let me think, man. I'll tell you, I mean, on The Hollow, there's a song called The Abandon that we've never played live, and it's literally because I can't sing it. Like, in the studio, I wrote that song, and I was like, in the chorus, it's like so high, dude. And I'm like, okay, this is sick, you know? And I was like listening to a lot of like Circus Survive and everything. So I'm thinking that I can do that. And we do it in the studio and we do a few takes and we get it. You know what I mean? But like night after night after night after night,
yeah,
like
good
I
luck.
Would trash my voice
yeah,
doing
good
that.
Luck, yeah.
So we got to practice and I was like, crap, Kellen, can you sing half this chorus? You know what I mean? And so I just learned through doing that record that I need to write things that I can perform live, that I can pull off live, mm-hmm. you know? And so that would be, like, I guess the closest thing to, you know, it sucks to say, like, you know, our first record, Sleepwalking, you know, it was such a valuable time in our career, like, learning, like, getting to know each other and learning who we were and me learning that, like, singing over Southern riffs was not for me because I'm not from the South and I didn't get it, you know? So I would say that, you know, there's a lot of failures that just made for great successes. That would be the most embarrassing thing is straight up saying like, yeah, I wrote a song that I can't do. Like,
can't sing live. You know yeah,
I mean? So we're not going to play it.
Yeah, it does suck you know? A little bit. Yeah. So you mentioned Sleepwalking and the Southern riffage and stuff like
yeah.
that. And you not liking to sing over it, obviously. A lot of people have asked if any kind of those Southern elements will be coming back into the music, later on in your career or whatnot, but I guess that kind
of... The Southern elements of how Kellen writes have always lived in our music. They've always been in every riff. I mean, if you go and listen to any song on any record, you'll hear that influence. I actually did an interview with Revolver for this new record, and we have like one ballad song, and they were like, is that a country song? And we're like, no, you know what I mean? But just Kellen's Southern roots, he grew up in Dallas, you know what I mean? And he grew up on Stone Temple and like bands that just had rad riffs like that, mm-hmm. and that will always exist in him as a writer. And always has. It just hasn't been as out front, twangy, like, you know,
right,
like,
right.
Since none of us listen to the Showdown anymore, you know what I mean? So it's like, but yeah, it always has lived in our music.
Cool.
Yeah.
What are some bands, whether you toured them or not, that you're listening to currently that we should probably like be on the lookout for?
Bands that I'm listening to that you guys haven't heard of. Dude, I'm not cool.
I mean,
like
even if we've heard of them, you know what I mean? Cause we obviously hear
Shay.
About them.
No, I'm just kidding.
Dan and Shay, everybody.
I mean, dude, the record's good. Period. The record's good. Let me look at my iTunes really quick.
Or is there anything that you're jamming? What are you jamming outside of the metalcore scene?
Dude, I got it. Lewis Capaldi.
Okay.
So he's a Scottish singer-songwriter. Last name is Capaldi. So I browse the charts, like the Billboard Top 100, just try to find something that'll be inspiring to me every now and again, and have struck out like a lot recently. And, you know, like the American charts, I was just so burnt out on it. And I was like, man, what are the British charts like right now? So I just decided to go jump over and check it out. And the number one song was this kid named Lewis Capaldi. And I was like, I've never even heard that name before. And I listened to the song and it literally brings me to tears. The first time that I listened to it. And I'm like, whoa, this is so powerful. So I look him up and he's like, he's a Scottish kid, but he's like an Instagram comedian. Like everything he does is like funny. But this song is like heart-wrenching. And so check that out.
Yeah, well,
you know, I haven't dove through any of his other discography, but the song is called Someone You Loved, and it's like, I would say front to back, one of the most well-written songs I've heard in years.
Cool. Yeah, we'll have to check it out. Alex, I know you have some prior engagements to go to today. Go ahead. We've kind of hit the limit here. I just was making sure you got everything in.
I just wanted to, you guys had a top five album. I think it was four.
Yeah.
That's gotta be, what was that like? Does that change everything for a band? You get bigger tours, bigger guarantees.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it definitely helps.
The respect of your relatives finally.
Yeah, they like the plaque for sure. I think it definitely helped with that, man. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with our new record, our first single and our first real attempt at radio ever, The song went top 20, and it lived in the top 20 for 6 weeks.
Cool.
And we did not think that that was going to happen. You know, like, we didn't think, we thought it was going to take a lot of time and building to make our way into radio because we just never existed there. And having a top 20 song has really been impactful for us as well, you know? Yeah, as much as the achievements side of things sucks because they're so few and far between and rare, they do help. Yeah.
What's the goal for Memphis Made Fire moving forward? Like, do you guys want to continue doing this forever, or do you guys want to split up and do some solo stuff? Obviously, you got your solo stuff, and you said your other guitar player is.
Man, it's hard. It's hard to, and I mean, you know, like, I'll probably eat this statement.
I mean,
later,
we know you're not going to break up. I'm not saying anything, but you know,
it just doesn't feel like apart. It doesn't feel like we'll ever break up. I think that we could definitely get to the point where we were playing a festival. Like doing the festival circuit,
mm-hmm.
and that's it, you know? Like, I think that, you know, into our 40s and stuff, like, if people still care about us at all, which there's a good chance they won't, maybe we could do that. But I can't imagine us, like, collectively getting together and being like, we don't ever want to do this ever again, ever. You know what I mean? But I don't know. I don't know. It really just depends on everyone's paths. I mean, the guys might start having kids soon, and you know, we're in our 30s, and it could happen. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But yeah, we're kind of, like, leaning towards active rock now, and we definitely want it to be Memphis Mayfire rock. Like, we want it to have art flavor to it. But that's just more along the lines of what we're listening to these days and,
right.
and what inspires us and the kind of touring that we want to do and the kind of bands that we want to tour with. And so leaning towards that world, it's like you definitely can get older and still have a lot of success in that world.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It's a little difficult and again, I'm speaking as a fan, you know, you want, I learned very early on that the bands I was very passionate about were always changing their sound.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of adapt to that.
Yeah, totally. Part.
Poison Well, one of those bands.
Poison Well's a great
Glass
band.
Glass Jaw is another band that I've followed forever. They've just drastically changed every album.
Yep.
But it doesn't, the younger audience members may not really understand that, you know, you are growing as a person too. And
totally.
That's something that is just lost on the fan, I guess, early on. But
totally.
Yeah, it's interesting to see bands grow over time.
Totally. I mean, what people want, dude, is they want you to recreate a nostalgic feeling that's not possible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't do it. Like, even if Under Oath's new record sounded like Define the Great Line, people still would have talked crap on it. Period.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because you felt a certain way about a certain song because you heard it at a certain time in your life. You know, like, I love They're Only Chasing Safety because I was 16 and I got my first car and my wife and I were driving around and she was so beautiful and I was so stoked and connected to the music and all that. And it was like, there's nothing Under Oath could ever do to recreate that feeling for
mm-hmm.
me. And what's funny is that, like, metalcore is even becoming kind of like a nostalgic thing. It's like, man, I loved you when I was in high school or whatever. So it's like, even though you grew out of metalcore and you listen to Post Malone now, you want me to write a record that sounds like what you listened to when you were 16?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, you want me to write a record that makes you feel 16 again, even though you don't even listen to metalcore anymore. You don't even buy albums anymore.
Yeah.
You don't even come to our shows anymore. Why are we writing music for you?
For you, yeah, exactly.
You know what
that's
I mean?
What
are you talking about? You know, like, we wanted to write a rock record. Yeah, we're going to write a rock record. We can't write music for our fans because we've never done that. We can't write music for them because then it's not our music. It's
mm-hmm.
not authentic. So we're going to write a record for us. And if you like it, that's awesome. And
yeah.
we're so thankful that you like it. If you don't, that's okay. There's a million other bands out there. And there's still some bands playing metalcore. You
yep,
know what
there
I mean?
Is, yeah. Well, so I also think a lot of people are just, you were saying, like, they'll have kids and, you know, your band members.
Totally.
I think a lot of bands that maybe did that earlier on, now their kids are a little older.
Totally.
They're getting back in the swing.
Totally.
Of things, you know what I mean?
And, dude, I'm all for the 10-year tours and the emo nights. I'm all for it, man. Absolutely. But don't for a minute think that when we sit down to write a record that we're trying to please you.
It comes into your head at all. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
All right. Do you,
I like that.
Do you have anything else, Hal?
One final question. How do you want to be remembered?
Man. That's
at the
awesome.
Ripe age of 30, you have to go ahead and discuss that.
That's an awesome question. Man, I guess
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, it's cool. I guess I
that,
would just
that is a tough one.
I would
want to
be remembered as someone who just always stayed the course. You know what I mean? Someone that, you know, I believe a certain thing. I like a certain thing when it comes to music and stuff like that. I want people to feel like I was always true to me, you know? And that I inspired people, hopefully, you know, I've gotten to talk to so many people all over the world that in one way or another somehow were affected by our music. And I don't know if that lives on forever or not. But it's been awesome. It's been an honor. It's been a wild ride, and I'm thankful for it.
Yeah.
You know? And, if for whatever reason something that I wrote gave someone hope or they found purpose in it or it helped them live another day when they were thinking about committing suicide, because so many people are going through that right now, I would hope that once I'm gone that maybe they remembered that. But yeah, I don't know.
Man, it kind of sucks. Awesome. You briefly in the beginning brought up your like hair care line, and I wanted to discuss that too, but you know, now we're sitting in like a minute, an hour 30.
No, it's all good, dude.
Just because I at one point had like a 3 foot long beard too, so
oh,
like,
nice.
I
cool,
got
man.
Into the whole like, you know, beard oils
totally.
and all that stuff. So I definitely wanted to explore that more with you. And I guess if you wanted to for the next 3 minutes or so like that, just you know, give yourself a
yeah,
plug.
If you care to hear about it, absolutely.
Go ahead. Yeah, yeah. I'm personally interested in all that
totally.
Stuff too.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
cool. Yeah, it's called On Point Pomade, and it started out as one product. I had a pompadour, and kind of like a slick back haircut, and I was looking for the perfect product and never found it, but stumbled across a lot of good products along the way. And so I really wanted to take like my favorite 5 hair products and all the good aspects of each of them and make one like super pomade that was perfect for me. And ultimately, that was just for me to use it, not for me to sell. You know what I mean? And we developed, me and my friend Jason, developed this hair product with a scientist from Oregon that I was so stoked about and so passionate about that I was like, let's make it a business. Absolutely. Let's offer it to the public. And who knows if anyone's going to want it or if they're going to care or if they're going to like it, because it's my thing. It's
right.
not like a, you know. And there was a ton of success behind it. And people really loved the product. And so after that, that was like a classic Shine Stronghold water soluble pomade. After that, I realized there's a lot of guys that use hair product that want a product that doesn't look like they're using product.
Right.
You know what I mean? So we developed a matte pomade and that was wildly successful. And by wildly successful, I mean as a startup. I don't mean like,
we sold 5.
We're not a
Fortune 500. We sold 5 out of my house.
Just very well received. I mean, people really enjoy it, you know? And so after that, we got into the world of beard oil, and I've got some friends with some very successful beard oil brands, and I picked their brains, and I had not used it, and I started growing my beard out to like develop ours so I could use ours and really figure out what we wanted ours to be like. And we just sourced some really high quality essential oils. Beard oil is actually very simple. Mm-hmm. Pomade's not. Pomade's complicated, but beard oil is very simple. It's, you know, whatever scent you want, high quality essential oils, whatever carrier oils you're wanting to use essentially. So we got some really high quality oils and we put the signature On Point scent that's in all of our products into that. And now that's become a thing and people really
yeah,
like it.
That's
so
really cool.
It's
cool
man.
To see other, you know, bands take, other avenues or other revenue streams.
Totally. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So.
I couldn't do a clothing line. I knew that I wasn't like, I didn't have some like
some stereotypical stuff.
Awesome
there, though, you know?
Idea for a clothing line. And so I didn't want to just do it to do it. And so when I found something, you know, I think that grooming products, at the root of it, like people want to look their best. People want to feel confident. So it's like, if I can create a product that makes people feel more confident, then that's awesome. And so that's what we do. And it's been awesome. It's been a crazy ride so far.
Yeah. You should definitely, sponsor a bunch of the people in the scene, because you know beers are heavily prevalent in the metal.
We do, we absolutely do. Jake from ABR actually uses the beard oil and loves
I've
it.
I've seen him post about it.
Yeah,
I didn't know it was yours per se. Yeah, okay.
No,
cool.
I appreciate the shameless plug though. Yeah.
No, I mean, I like the fact that you know, like I said, it's not just about you and Memphis Mayfire.
Yeah.
Beforehand, so it's cool to show that you do other things outside of that too.
Totally.
So that's pretty cool, man. Well, I appreciate your time, Matt.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys having me on. This is cool. From everything I've ever read, I don't think you guys as fans like us very much. So I was like,
it's two separate things.
I don't know if it, yeah.
There's fans and then there's
I think
people
that's
who comment.
That's a common experience amongst fans. I don't think the readers like anything really. If you believe what they read, so, take it all with a grain of salt, but, yeah, I really appreciate the
absolutely
the conversation and the candor.
It's the anonymous internet.
It's really cool talking to you.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me, man.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.